Hey, this is Nimesh Patel. I'm a stand-up comedian, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Yeah. My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. Hi, everyone. On this episode of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, we share a conversation with comedian Nimesh Patel. Stay tuned. Once again, thank you for listening and for sharing it with your friends and family, for rating and kindly reviewing it, and for following along on social media. Whether it's your first episode or it's first up on your weekly playlist, it's very much appreciated and I'm quite grateful. So as I've asked a few times in the past, who doesn't like to laugh? It's a terrific mode of connection, and even if each one of us has our own mental model and fingerprint of what tickles us and hits us as clever, knowing that it could possibly link us to another human who feels the same way is just pretty damn cool. So in 2024, in a world where there's millions of things that speak right now to gravitas and sobriety, it's not surprising that many are seeking both comic relief and even further comic exploration from Indian American comedian Nimesh Patel. Nimesh is an Emmy-nominated writer and a stand-up comedian who last year was one of Variety's 10 comics to watch and also part of Netflix's Verified Stand-Up. He's someone who's truly made me laugh out loud, and so I'm kind of thankful for two things. One, that he bailed on a career in finance to pursue writing and comedy. And two, that Chris Rock saw him perform and hired him to tour and then write comedy for him at the Academy Awards. Since that discovery, Nimesh has written for Saturday Night Live, A Little Late with Lily Singh, and the White House Correspondents' Dinner. He's a favorite on the late night circuit, and even more, he's had multiple specials, including Thank You China, Jokes to Get You Through Quarantine, and Lucky Lefty, which actually shared some of his experiences having testicular cancer in his own very unique and funny way. Now, if you watch him online or in person, it's his unmistakable swagger that commands the stage with a blend of street confidence, a strangely humble arrogance, and an infectiously endearing giggle of both vulnerability and vibrancy. Now, make no mistake, Nimesh's comedy is raw, it's boundary pushing, it's smart, it's quick and clever, and at the right times, it can be pretty, well, Indian. I had a chance to catch up with him as he's been doing a few pop-up sets in between his ongoing Fast and Loose tour to talk about everything from the anatomy of his jokes to being irreverent to his pre-show routines. But of course, I wanted to remind him of a very important fact before we got started. So first up, I know you're like the first Indian American on SNL and as a writer, and which kind of makes you kind of like brown comedy Jesus and all that. But I counted it up. You're the eighth Patel on this show. So I guess out of 200 guests, that's about right. But you're just another Guju for now here. So
yeah. Happy to be one of many.
Seriously, no, your comedy actually has been a real sort of breath of fresh air for me, at least. I mean, I've been laughing out loud, especially with some of your latest stuff. I saw one of your videos where you actually were asking somebody if they have gone alone to a comedy show, and I guess they had. I'm just curious for you now. I mean, have you ever done that? And now, like at this point in your career, are you watching comedy any differently than you did before?
The only time before I started comedy that I went to a show alone, I got barked into the Comedy Cellar. This is in 2004 because I've told the story before, but I don't think on a podcast or anything, but
yeah.
I was walking past the Cellar because I went to NYU. I think I'd gotten a slice of pizza after studying for finals or something. And I was walking past the Cellar and someone barked me in saying Chappelle was on stage. I was like, there's no way Dave Chappelle's on stage. And this is 2004. So it wasn't like the Cellar is now, which is in its heyday, like crazy packed all the time. It was like they were barking people in. And I was like, there's no way Dave's on stage. And they're like, no, he's up. And it was like $20. So I was like, okay. And I went in. I was like, oh shit, it's Dave Chappelle.
Right.
But I wasn't into comedy at the time. I was just like, well, let me just, it's Dave Chappelle. Let's go see. And I stayed there for like, I think 15, 20 minutes. He made fun of me like the instant I walked in. I remember it very clearly.
Yeah.
And I had a backpack. So he said, sir, we have to check your bag. Your skin's a little too olive. And that obviously hit the room pretty hard. And I don't remember his set at all, what he said, what he was talking about, but I remember just leaving after like 20 minutes because I couldn't drink because I was 19 or something.
Yeah.
And I had to go study. But now I don't watch comedy at all. I'll go to comedy shows from time to time if like my friends are performing. But it's usually just to hang out and have a drink backstage. Just never to like, I'll watch some sets just to see like how and what my friends are talking about and like enjoy their stuff, but never seeking it out the way for entertainment or anything, except for Dave Attell's special, which is on Netflix, Hot Cross Buns, which is like, I watched the first 20 minutes, 30 minutes so far. He just texted me saying, because I texted him saying how good it was. It's just insane. Go watch that. Like, stop anything you're doing and go watch
Run, Hot Cross Buns.
If you like just pure fucking comedy, like that's just joke.
So, I mean, like when that does happen and like you get like a great, great set like that or something you're really interested in. I mean, you know, nowadays, does that like feed into like how you're either prepping or, and I mean, even for like the stuff that I listen to of yours or I've watched is like, I mean, it just makes me like literally crack up. And in that way, like for yourself, when you find yourself in those kind of private moments, when you kind of crack yourself up, is that fodder for what you're about to experiment with? Or is there stuff that just stays private?
There's a line between like what makes me laugh and what I'll do on stage. It's very often that anything that makes me laugh in person, I'll try to do on stage at some point in some way or another. But sometimes things that make me laugh are just like nonsense that like I witnessed during the day that there's no way I'd be able to translate it to the stage. Like yesterday I wrote a joke about something that happened in an elevator, and it was just a tag to a very old joke that I had, and it made me laugh like immediately for the first time. Like I laughed out loud for the first time in a while, and I was like, I can't wait to say this on stage, and I said it on stage and it worked perfectly. So I was like, so that will happen, but more often than not, it's just giggling to myself about something stupid that there's no way that'll make itself on stage.
Right.
With the tell, like to answer the first part of your question, it's influential it's inspirational in the way, you know, the great comics just constantly write and beat stuff up and like really play to their audience.
Yeah.
And Dave is a master in every shape or form and form. It's just so inspirational to see. It makes me think like, I got to cancel this podcast and go start writing stuff. You know, it's like, that's really like, that'll happen. I'm like, I got to work. Like I can't do anything but work. Because that's what the feeling I get sometimes from some people.
Well, I mean, like, hey, we'll try and shorten this so you get back to work, I guess, in that way.
No, I'm just saying, you know, like that, like I watched my friend Jared Fried the other day at Town Hall in New York, and I was just like blown away. This is a guy I started with, you know, we've been together for 13 years, 14 years, and like seeing him hit like this next gear in his comedy just like blew my mind. And I was like, I gotta stop hanging out. I should not be here. I gotta go home and write some jokes and figure out my material because it's just crazy inspirational.
I mean, you're saying a lot about like what a lot of people do where they just sort of iterate and riff but they get motivated by it because they're this latest Fast and Loose tour that you're on. It seems at least like from what you're putting out there, it's a lot of free riffing and experimentation and having like a test lab every night so you can throw the Ambani line or the Jay Shetty line and tampons and let's shit incubate a little bit. Mm-hmm. Is this somewhat liberating for you where you're just sort of out there and you can see how this plays out and have that kind of test lab?
Well, the stuff that I put out on the internet is stuff that I won't be doing on the tour. It's more just like, it's like I have a weekly show in New York City that I started for the sole purpose of burning material and being able to test the stuff that I'm doing on the road before I actually do it on the road to see like and iterate on it, really.
Yeah.
So like the stuff that I put out in the last few weeks is either stuff that I won't be doing again, stuff that I did on the tour that I'm like, yeah, I don't really like this anymore. I think I put some clips up from my show at Madison Square Garden.
Where
people like, this was a crazy set. Like you should keep it. But I'm like, nah, I just don't want to do this material anymore. It was a great time, but who cares?
Right.
What's liberating is knowing that I still have, liberating and constricting at the same time, that I have like, you know, still like 2 months of tour left, you know, probably like 30, 40 shows left where I will be able to iterate like a bunch of times on the stuff that I actually still kind of really like and want to figure out.
Yeah.
The Fast and Loose tour, I named it that because the other two tours, Lucky Lefty and Thank You China, those tours, like I had gone into those shows knowing exactly what I wanted to talk about and kind of the order and the structure of sets. This is really a lot more free form. I'm not like riffing with the crowds. It's more just like,
yeah,
the set is not fully figured out. The jokes are not fully figured out. The structure, even within the bits, like the I'm rearranging joke order and all that kind of stuff. And so
yeah,
that's why it's called Fast and Loose. And it's been fun. I'm not sure if you saw me in San Francisco, but the set was very different from San Francisco to San Jose. And it was only like 2 or 3 months apart. And yeah, then when I go back to LA, it'll be very different, which is in May. And then, you know, by the end of the tour, it'll be an entirely different show than when I started it back in London.
I sheepishly will say I have not caught your shows, but for the most part, that's a plan for me. Do you prefer that, by the way, where there's like, you do have the capacity to experiment, change, make the show and the sets slightly different? Does it tend to, you know, not have, when it doesn't have that kind of structure, you can sort of play with that a little bit?
It kind of makes me nervous sometimes when I'm going up. I'm like, I really haven't thought about, well, I know the jokes and I know the bits, but I haven't really figured out what order I want to do tonight. Or
yeah,
but I kind of have fun with that a little bit as well.
Right.
I don't go up unprepared by any means. It's more like I know what I want to hit. It's like, let's see if I can kind of play jazz with it on stage a little bit.
Yeah,
and I go up against the like a lot of my audience. It's their first time seeing a comedy show, or the first time they've ever been to a show. They've seen like Husson or Chappelle.
Yeah.
And Husson is like through and through, like knows the set in and out, fully structured. Chappelle is structured, but he'll and also kind of loose with it. But even within his structure, even within his looseness, he's kind of structured. I've seen him a few times.
Yeah.
And so like I'm coming up against people who have like very either no expectations and don't know anything, or they have like, this is what comedy is kind of thing. And so that's always a fun challenge to kind of navigate and like educate them that no, sometimes a comic's just on stage at a club and just figuring stuff out.
Yeah.
And that's, it's arrogant, but you pay for the privilege to watch someone at work kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And hopefully they execute to the highest of their capabilities, but you're not paying money to see the Knicks win. You're hoping they win, and you're hoping you get that full joyful experience, but really you're paying to see them do what they do.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, let's come back to our conversation with Nimesh Patel. Stay tuned. Every story told is a lesson learned, and every lesson learned is a story waiting to be told. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, this is Nimesh Patel. I'm a stand-up comedian on tour, a Fast and Loose tour. Get tickets at fastandloosetour.com, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tam France.
Hey, this is Cal Penn.
Hi, my name is Richa Morjani, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with comedian Nimesh Patel.
Do you have a pre-show routine? Like, I go into every single doctor's office visit, and I do the exact same thing before I go in. I mean, do you have a pre-show sort of routine that you're like, hey, if I don't do this, it just throws me off my game?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of LeBron it in the sense of I got to nap, I got to work
out.
In the air and, I do cocaine.
Right, right.
I have to nap, I got to work out, I got to eat right, I got to take a walk, I got to read something.
Yeah.
I got to look at my set, I got to write it down on paper as opposed to a computer.
Yeah.
And then literally right before I get on stage, I'm doing like a, what's it called? I'm touching my toes for like 10, 20 seconds.
Okay.
Just to get the blood going to my brain.
There you go.
And make sure I have a full bottle of water before I go on stage, and then a bottle of water on stage with me. And yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
It's and not necessarily in any specific order. It's just like what I can, whatever I feel like doing, but those things I have to hit. Like I gotta do those things.
Well, I mean, I imagine that, like, you know, there's a level of like sort of peace with that, right? Like, hey, I'm ready. Mm. Does the temperature or the tone in the audience feel any different when there aren't that many Indians? And does that sort of change the level of kind of trust or the relationship you build with an audience in any given night?
I think that's a good question. I think I've been fortunate that outside of the big cities, in the like the second tier cities, I want to say like a Jacksonville or a Denver or Minneapolis, like my crowds are...
You played Kansas City or...
I did Kansas City this past summer, Omaha. In a lot of those places, my crowds are a lot more diverse.
Yeah.
They're probably more reflective of Chappelle's audience than they are of Husson's audience. Mm. You know? It's probably more like Aziz's audience in most of those places.
Sure.
But when I go to major cities, San Fran, San Jose, where there is a huge Indian population, they do come out. And the... The temperature, and this might be wrong, but I feel like Indian audiences have a lot higher expectations. Mm. And I'm always, because they're less used to comedy.
Sure.
Like stand-up comedy in the Indian community is relatively new.
Yeah.
You know, it's, especially in my generation, you know, like I'm 38. And so like my age, people in like maybe another 10 years above me, like Russell, Aziz, Husson, Mindy, maybe, but you know, Mindy's not stand up, and a few others, and Akash and a few others, like we're comedy.
Yeah.
And so when people come out to see Indian people come out to see comedy, it's a very different thing than when white or black or Hispanic people come out to see, because they're a bit more educated on what comedy is in general. Like sometimes it's comedy at a theater and dudes in the newest outfit from Mr. Porter and looking fresh as fuck. And other times it's at a club.
Yeah.
Where it's jeans and a tee just and notes on stage kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think Indian audiences are more used to the former than the latter. And so when it comes out, t-shirt, jeans, like a little loose and fast.
Yeah.
It's a different thing, you know, for better or for worse. Like I think Indian audiences are also a lot more pumped to hear stuff about them than most audiences are, because they're like, oh, this is our guy. He's talking specifically to our experience. And that's a cool thing to hit. So net, all the crowds have been great. Indian audiences are fun to kind of poke fun at and subvert those expectations. Like, I think sometimes Indian crowds will come out and think, oh, he's going to just talk about being Indian. We can't wait.
Yeah.
And then it's drugs and alcohol and sex, whatever it is I'm talking about at the time. And that's fun to kind of also play with.
Yeah. I mean, so we on this show, at least, we've talked a lot about like mirrors and windows and... There's a Russell Peters lines, of course, where like he's like, Russell, show Uncle your dance and all that, right? And mm-hmm. I have to say, like, you know, when I watched that years ago, that was a total mirror where it's like, okay, like you said, right? You go to a show and you're like, hey, this guy's, someone's, you know, talking about me. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of non-Indians, that's a total window, right? Like, especially they haven't heard something like that before. They're like, oh, okay, I guess, you know, now someone's riffing a little bit on what that experience is like. Have you had aha moments like that where people have come up to you afterwards and they've been like, wow, that really was quite reflective of what I think this community is all about, even though it's obviously not monochromatic. There's a lot there to it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, from both Indian and non-Indian people, I've had like I'm doing a bit about growing up, learning about religion. And then growing up with a mom who has superstitions, and those are so specific. There's some of them are so specific to the Indian community. People are like, I cannot believe, I thought I was the only one whose mom told them that you couldn't ride in a car with an odd number of people.
Right.
And And people are like, that is fuck that. I had no idea.
Right.
And so like, that's like a mirror, but it's also a window into the world of, not to say being Indian, but just like having a mom who believes in that,
right,
or whatever that impact can be on your psychology.
Sure.
And that's agnostic of race. It could just be anybody can relate to that. And so people have definitely come up and like, someone said something the other day, said, I mentioned having a Toyota Corolla.
Yeah.
And someone's like, you talking about having a Toyota Corolla lets people know you're Indian without having to be like, this guy grew up Indian.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And totally. So it's like that is like the goal, to kind of get to that with some of the bits. Like, you can tell, you can say what I'm, you can picture how I live without me having to be expository about it.
And does that kind of help the message scale that much more? Right. Because it's sort of more subtle. It's more of a subversive way of saying it without saying it.
Yeah, I think that is the goal. I think when I started comedy, someone asked me this the other day, and I have a sort of canned answer for it about talking about being Indian, and you don't talk about being Indian enough, that kind of thing. It's like, everything I do is Indian. And so I don't necessarily need to say this is an Indian thing, unless it's like specifically like very Indian, like only Indian people understand what a puja is necessarily, you know? But I think when you highlight this is Indian stuff, it removes the ability to scale.
Sure.
People subconsciously and consciously are like, next, this is not for me.
Yeah.
Whereas if you put it in the details, I have a Toyota Corolla. My mom would get up at 5 o'clock every day and pray and bang pots and pans around.
Yeah.
Without having to say it beyond anything beyond that, you get that is like that. If it's kind of specifically Indian, but it's universal enough that you could pick and choose whatever you want to have it mirror in your life, and increases the scale for sure.
Yeah. And let me ask you kind of about that. I mean, you're a Hindu, you refer a lot to a lot of Hindu things, reincarnation in your comedy. And you've spoken about seniors and your grandfather and like sort of like the importance of that in your life and, you know, Krishna, Hanuman, etc. And yet, you know, your general material is super irreverent, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious about boundaries for you as an artist. Like, how do they get defined for you or not? I mean, is that actually important not to have boundaries? Like, in a way, like, what do you find reverent? Do you have a reverence for something? You're like, hey, that's off limits.
I do not have a reverence for anything where I'm like, I cannot talk about this. Like, just yesterday, I started talking about having an alcoholic brother. And that was something I had avoided talking about, but only because I never broached the topic with him in like, hey, this is something I'm going to be talking about. But that wasn't out of reverence. It was reverence for him as opposed to boundaries or anything like that.
Yeah.
But I'll talk about my parents. I'll talk about my family. I'll talk about anything and everything. As long as I can find a way to make it funny without hurting the feelings of people that I care about. So maybe I do have a reverence for like the family aspect of it all.
Yeah. Yeah.
But only because I don't want to talk shit about them without letting them know that I might be talking shit about.
Right. Right.
Once I get that clearance, it's like, yeah, it's all good.
Yeah.
And as sad as it is, I've probably said more to my parents and to my family through stand-up than I have via actual conversation. Like, I think in Thank You China, talking about how crazy it was, my dad was just working all the time.
Yeah.
And how I found it crazy that he would go to work instead of like bunkering down, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I said that we had that argument first, like over the phone in real life. And then once it was clear that he was not going to change or kind of, you know, adapt his behavior to the times, I was able to kind of laugh at it and process it. And that ended up being a joke.
Right. Right.
And ended up saying a lot more about him and the country and work ethic and all that than, you know, I could have said, like, my dad has a work ethic, but, you know, like, I said that without saying it. I think I've meandered away from the question a little bit.
No. I mean, I wonder if a lot of this stuff, right, whether it's about your family, whether it's about Hinduism, sort of it makes it out there on stage, and there's a catharsis and a therapeutic aspect to some of this getting on.
Well, people get mad at the Hindu stuff, and that just makes me want to talk more about Hinduism, because it's like, how, and I'm not like by any means the most devout person in the world. It's just, for more better or worse, it's insurance in this case. But
right,
like it's if I'm gonna have a way to view the world very loosely, then it's an interesting way to look at things.
Absolutely.
I don't necessarily agree, or not agree, but believe in all the mythology and all that. That there's no scientific, I'm still like a logical person.
Yeah.
It's just like, I don't fully believe in all the mythology and stuff, but if I'm gonna read some tenets from it, you know, don't be angry, like don't necessarily work for the sake of getting some kind of end result, but work because that's what you're compelled to do. And if you're, the key to happiness is to not be tied to the end results of your work, then you will be a happier person. Like, that's a cool thing to take away from Hinduism.
Yeah.
But when people get mad at me for making fun of Hanuman or Krishna, I'm just like, you did not read the book. You know, it's like, and that makes me want to be more antagonistic and irreverent.
Yeah.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with comedian Nimesh Patel. Stay tuned. Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, this is Vidya Balan, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hi, guys. I'm Indra Nui.
Hey, this is Samir Gadia.
Hi, this is Madhuri Dixit, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Hi there. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Nimesh Patel.
I'm curious, you develop a lot of your skills as a writer, right? I mean, like that sort of is where it all is, the foundation is at, I'm imagining. Is there at all an anatomy of a good joke? Like how it develops, how it generates momentum, even how it even should linger and last. Have you figured out that formula?
I'll say that my comedy has been kind of all over the place in the sense of, like, some jokes are very long, some bits have like throwaways in between.
Yeah.
Really, for me, the fun is like, sometimes my fingers will detach from my brain and like they'll come up with some, like, I don't want to say the joke that I came up with yesterday, but it was just something that just, I don't know where it came from, but it made me laugh aloud.
Yeah.
And I think without having actually codified it, I think I have figured it out.
Yeah.
I have never really codified what that is. I think the most obvious thing is just like subvert that expectation, say something that sometimes I'll say a joke that I know will make people upset or would make people upset.
Yeah.
And I know is wrong to say. And that is more the joke than the actual joke.
Sure. The provocation, maybe.
Yeah. That, to me, that's the bigger joke than actually the written part of it. Like that, I put a joke up about seeing a woman therapist.
Yeah.
And I don't respect her opinion being the punchline. And it was just like, I know that that's wrong, and I know that that's why I got to say it, and that's why it's fun to me.
Yeah.
And I think if I have any through line through my writing, it's like, what's the most annoying thing I could say at this time?
Yeah.
And so that's like how I kind of write a lot of it.
Yeah.
At least the more irreverent stuff.
From that perspective, then, as a writer, I mean, is there a gap sometimes between writing and performing where you leave your written material for someone else to perform, sort of like that SNL style where, you know, it's your work, but it's getting out there with someone else. Does that gap ever make you anxious if you're writing for someone else? And for that matter, were there actors, you know, comic or otherwise, or performers whose expression not only matched what your writing was, but it kind of elevated. And you're like, wow, look at that. Like they did a great job with that material.
I haven't written for anyone but myself for the last 4 or 5 years, I want to say.
Yeah.
No, maybe even longer than that. No, I think Lily Singh was the last person I wrote jokes for like when I was writing on her show.
Sure.
In 2020, 2021. But even that, like she wasn't taking my stand-up and making it her own. It was more like sketches and a few monologue bits here and there.
Yeah.
So I don't know necessarily how to perfectly answer your question. I think for me, when I'm writing stuff now, it's just for me.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to like that. That's half the reason, a lot of the reason I don't watch anything or listen to anybody.
Sure.
Is because I'm just in my own head and I want to make sure that I'm talking to myself. And like myself as more than anybody else. The few times I've had jokes said by other comedians, whether it be on Update or Rock, they've definitely obviously taken it to their own level and put their own twist on it. And it's just, it's fun to see that happen.
Yeah.
But even then, a lot of those jokes are still just things that I would say had I not been hired to write them for somebody else.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, a good thing. Like, it's very hard for me to like get in the head of somebody else.
Yeah.
And like write like them.
Yep.
And so when I write for myself, now it's just the most freeing thing.
Yeah.
Like, it's all mine. This is exactly how I would say these things.
Right. Right. Do you ever Google yourself? By the way, I mean, like, do you have that? Is it part of the feedback loop to, in a way, define success? And Google might be the proxy for just being able to say, hey, how do I in fact find out more about like, hey, is my stuff landing?
You know, I definitely check my growth numbers on Instagram and TikTok and Twitter and all that shit every day. That's more an addiction than it is a measurement of my own accomplishments or strength or growth as a comic.
Sure.
You know, I think I take more feeling out of the negative than I do the positive, which is something I have to work on. You know, like the negative stuff hits me a lot harder than the positive stuff does. Of course.
Yeah.
Which is probably just like in theory, an easy switch to make, but in practice it's very difficult.
Yeah.
And the best way to stop being impacted by that is to just stop doing it altogether, checking those comments and all that stuff. But yeah. I would be lying if I said I don't check those things, that they don't impact me in some way or another. I'm sure like it's death by 1,000 cuts,
yeah,
versus like one big one. But yeah, like I think like the true measure is like when I get on stage and people are laughing,
right?
That wins everything. You know, like I'll say jokes, I'll put jokes up on the internet that people, what is this trash? And then I'll be on stage and do the same jokes and be like, applause and laughs. And
yeah.
Like people, like I got to wait to tell the next joke because people are still waiting. Yeah. Not done laughing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that I got to put that more in my mind than the comments and all that kind of stuff.
I was just going to say, I mean, you know, some success would, you know, be simply beating cancer or writing for Chris Rock.
Yeah.
Or graduating from NYU or is that something that's elusive? Because there's always this sort of like next thing to gain or next place to evolve. I mean, does that in the end sort of like serve as this constant motivation?
I've made it as a comic, which is a hard thing to like actually feel.
Yeah.
But I have, right? Like I got this apartment. People respect me. I'm on the wall at the Cellar. I've worked with, you know, the greatest. I sold out some of the biggest rooms in the country.
Sure.
But that fulfillment is elusive for sure. Because I like when I started comedy, and to this day, I still don't necessarily, quote unquote, know what I'm doing. This is just me kind of chasing a car that's a dog chasing a car.
Yeah.
Luckily, I'm too stupid to know that I'm never going to catch that car.
Yeah.
You know, and so like I just got to appreciate the fact that I get to be a dog and run wild. And that's really what it is.
Yeah.
Like I do live a dog's life. Like I do whatever I want, whenever I want, for whatever reason.
Well, and yeah. I mean, you know, that can be frustrating for some people. But I guess if you have enough peace with it, then that's great. You know, in 2024 and beyond, sort of like as your work grows, you might have people discovering your material for the first time or coming to a show to see you. For those folks, maybe after they've experienced your work, how do you hope they feel?
I hope they feel like they had an escape from the world for a little bit, or that they could go back and look at some part of their lives and laugh at it through the lens I've provided. But really just like they had a good time, and they, for, you know, an hour or two, they got to laugh and enjoy themselves. That's really it. You know, I'm not out here, despite any political stuff I put out or anything like that, I'm not here to change minds and make people get out and vote and all that kind of stuff. There are people that get paid a lot more money to fuck that kind of stuff up. You know, like I'm just here to provide a little bit of escape. And if you walk away thinking, man, that was fun and nice, and I never thought that I would view waiting in line for the bathroom like that again, like that, you know, then, okay, cool. I've impacted you in some small way that hopefully will ripple in one way or another. You know, like if I made a doctor laugh for a half a second, maybe he won't overcharge his patients for, you know, like maybe, you know, like
maybe
that's right. That's really it. But I beyond like having them feel a little happier than they were when they came in, I don't really have any giant aspirations. And hopefully at scale, that means like a lot of people are happier a little bit. And maybe that means something.
Well, whether it's a comic's life, a dog's life, making doctors charge less, but more importantly, honestly, making people escape for a little bit and have some comic relief in their lives. Nimesh, thank you so much for joining. This was really a treat. I hope we can catch up with you down the line sometime in the future.
For sure. No, thank you very much. I appreciate you're a great interviewer. I appreciate the research and work that you've done. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks so much, Nimesh. And please check him out online, and of course, over the next few months on his Fast and Loose tour. So what's worse than having a bunch of ants in your pants? A bunch of aunties. Worse than that, of course, a bunch of uncles. Till next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.